I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. On social media, today's guest, Afghan journalist Ali Latifi, commented on this Reuters headline from Wednesday. U.S. considers visas for vulnerable Afghan women after military exit. Ali Latifi wrote, "If this is a 2021 headline, then Washington really needs to ask themselves what their 20-year military excursion actually achieved." Well, joining us to talk about that question is Ali Latifi, an independent journalist based in Kabul. His writing has appeared in many publications, including the New York Times and the Los Angeles Times. Ali produced a recent segment for the PBS NewsHour with correspondent Jane Ferguson and wrote a piece for Al Jazeera about Afghans who were taking up arms because of Taliban advances. Hi, Ali. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Ali, as you know, the Taliban are dominating headlines. In fact, the BBC's first two stories were about the Taliban. Before we talk about that and how you think the media should cover this now, I want to ask you a pretty big question. You were just in three different provinces talking to people on the ground. How are people reflecting after 20 years of, as you called it, a military excursion after the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan?
You know, the thing is that people have been skeptical of the U.S. presence for a long time. I mean, ever since I first came back in 2011, I remember these skepticisms and these criticisms. But now, you know, it's much more upfront. You know, people are saying that, you know, they came here for their self-interest and they're leaving in their self-interest. Some people are confused by what Joe Biden said. Was it yesterday or today? I'm sorry. I'm just trying to figure out the U.S. time. But in his speech where he said that, you know, the U.S. was never here for nation building, and, you know, people say, then why was so much money spent on NGOs and aid programs and things like that? And people who were part of the first bond conferences were saying that, you know, that was a big part of what was being said about Afghanistan and you know, the entire international force here. Whether or not, you know, the actually nation building was done in good faith or was effective is something else, but I think that it was billed that way, and whether or not it played out that way, to hear Joe Biden say outright that it wasn't, even though he voted for this war, you know, is quite interesting, you know?
Well, what are you hearing from people whose lives have been shaped by years of war and foreign military involvement over the past 20 years?
It's what they said. You know, it's this idea of, you know, this global power coming in for their own interest, you know, coming in when they decide to come in and leaving when they decide to leave I mean, because a lot of people are saying, you know, it's fine. No one expected them to stay even this long. You know, 20 years is a long time. But the only thing is that an unconditional withdrawal without any sort of parameters or oversight on the Taliban in any sort of way, even if not a full ceasefire, some kind of a reduction in violence or some kind of a real actual commitment by the government and by the Taliban to seriously begin negotiations and really move towards some kind of a settlement. That's the thing that angers people the most, because they feel like, you know, if you're going to go, but at least make sure that there's something happening that's more than just what's happening right now, which is just the war intensifying, something that looks like some kind of a progress towards a settlement or a peace.
What are your thoughts about the coverage overall, Ali? Your colleague, Emran Faraz, who we've had on the show, who's an Afghan journalist, said recent Afghan coverage is pretty problematic. Many journalists and analysts focus on Taliban gains and the Afghanization of war, while withdrawing troops are portrayed as the good forces who should have saved the country. The truth is, many of them are war criminals.
He's not wrong. I think it is sort of interesting. Yeah, it is sort of this whole, how do I put it? It's like, you know, this almost like a revisionism or an idealization of, oh, well, okay, so I'll give you an example. In May, when there was that bombing on the girls' school in West Kabul and Dashtabachi that targeted young Hazara girls, I remember I was being asked by different TVs and radios and so on, like, you know, what does this mean in terms of the U.S. withdrawal? And I kept saying, this was happening while the U.S. was here. You know, this is sadly not something new. You know, the Hazaras have been under attack. Schools have been under attack. Girls have been under attack. You know, the entire country has been under attack by, you know, by the Taliban and by the so-called Daesh forces and all of this, even while the U.S. was here. So why are we acting as if, you know, had they stayed one day more, this might have been avoided? So I think in that way, he is correct. And, you know, a lot of, like, we saw a lot of headlines of, oh, they left Bagram, and, like, Bagram is, like, the biggest air base, and it's the center of U.S. activity here. But people also forget that Bagram prison was highly feared. And there were a lot of people who talked about the torture and abuse and, you know, being arrested on unproven, unsubstantiated crimes and going through, you know, this torture, this abuse, this, you know, I mean, some people would say it's worse than Guantanamo. And so, yeah, there is something about, you know, like people say like, oh, well, if only there was air support or we need more air support. But as much as air support does help in the war, there have also been repeated instances of when the foreign forces were conducting airstrikes and drone strikes of civilians being killed. Same thing with Afghan forces. It's sort of like this, how do I put it? It's sort of like this reminiscence of war, you know, never really thinking about what is the effect of that war. You know, how often are you killing civilians and, you know, or even like, okay, so like the 20 years of war that was here, you know, people keep asking what's next and what's next. Nobody knows, right? You'll never know until it happens. But I think what should be asked is more, what happened? How did we get to this place where in 2021, the Taliban are still able to take districts, are still, you know, are still a thing. They're still a force. And that they, you know, make a peace with the United States, who they see as the ultimate occupier, and yet not with the government of Afghanistan. Or the fact that, like, you know, I keep saying, like, you know, there's still so many places without proper roads, or like, you know, the streets of Kabul flood when it rains, or, you know, not having 24-hour electricity, or having a government that, you know, keeps coming under question from the population, and all of this corruption and fraud and all of these things. You know, I think that that's more of a constructive question, because nobody knows what's going to happen a day from now, much less, you know, a month or a year from now. But I think we all knew what happened, you know, over the last 20 years. And I think we really need to sort of take stock of that and hold people to, because if you listen to like Joe Biden's speech, you know, and anytime he talks about Afghanistan, you know, when he had that July 4th question, he's like, I want to talk about fun things, no more about Afghanistan. You know, it shows the level of disdain he has for this country. And on the one hand, you know, the one good thing about Biden and Trump compared to their predecessors is that they're both very upfront about how they feel about this war. And I think that that's good. I think that, you know, people need to see, people in the United States and people here need to see that. They need to understand that, like, they may not have your best interests at heart. You know, they may just feel like they're stuck in this quagmire and they're just looking for a way out.
And we should say, Ali, for people who aren't familiar with that, so last Friday, reporters were asking Biden questions about Afghanistan, and he wanted to talk about, you know, people going out and enjoying the 4th of July in the United States. And he said, I want to talk about happy things, basically shutting down questions of Afghanistan.
Yeah. And so I think that, you know, these are the conversations that should be had. Because as I said, like, the future is up in the air. Nobody knows what's going to happen.
Right. Ali, I want to ask you about Bagram, since you brought it up. And as you said, the headlines were the U.S. left in the middle of the night. Bagram was the largest military base in Afghanistan, and people called it basically Afghanistan's Guantanamo. Mozambeg, who is an ex-Guantanamo prisoner, tweeted recently, "In Bagram, U.S. soldiers would shackle our wrists to the top of the door and leave us for hours. In 2002, I witnessed the murder of two prisoners made to stand like this. Donald Rumsfeld gave the orders." And I understand, Ali, there are 5,000 mostly Taliban prisoners currently in Bagram. Can you give us any updates on that?
That's what we've been told, but to be quite honest, I haven't been there, you know, recently to know. But again, this is the thing, you know, when they say mostly Taliban prisoners, like Mozambique, right? Like there's a lot of assumptions. There's a lot of bad information. You don't know who is. It is possible to find out who is an actual Talib and who is not. But when you look at the cases and when you look at the reports that come out of places like Bagram and Guantanamo, that often isn't done. And that in itself makes the situation much worse. I mean, Hamid Karzai, when he was president, he used to call it a Taliban-making factory because of that. You know, because I remember a year ago when the Taliban prisoners started being freed. And I remember we saw them because we were driving back from Wardak province. And I asked one of our friends who's from there, I said, "Do you think they'll go back to fighting?" And he said, "If they've been tortured, they will absolutely go back. If they felt like they were abused in prison, if they felt like they were tortured in prison, they will absolutely go back to fighting." And so these kinds of things have an impact, and I think that when you sort of gloss over them, I mean, there was someone, they were tweeting like this whole list of like what happened in Bagram, and one of them was that the U.S. launched the mother of all bombs, which is like the largest non-nuclear device in the world, that they dropped on a province on a village in the eastern province of Nangarhar, you know, in 2017, and no one ever talks about, well, why was the largest non-nuclear device on Earth dropped on this village and what did it really achieve? Because they claim that they killed 90-something Daesh members, and then they said that like they were from all these countries. They listed a whole bunch of, which is so, because it's like, if it's like this massive, almost atomic bomb, what's left of their bodies for you to identify? How do you even know how many of them were there? And then on top of that, how would you know where they were from? You know, but these kinds of things just don't get questioned so often. They just kind of get glossed over, or certain things just sort of get romanticized.
Ali, you were actually there the day after that bomb dropped, and again,
that
a couple
morning,
weeks later.
We left Kabul at like 6 or 7 in the morning, and then I went a couple weeks later, and that was the interesting thing, is like the day after, we stayed for 2 or 3 days, and that entire time we were never allowed into the village, and there were still U.S. helicopters flying overhead. The Afghan army went in much later on the day after than you know, up until that point they hadn't even been there themselves. The U.S. had been there, but they hadn't. And then when we went back, I want to say it was like 10 days to 2 weeks later, there was more fighting in that same area. We like, there was active gunshots and helicopters flying again, which is like, if you killed all of these so-called like Islamic State fighters, then why is the fighting worse at least a week, if not 2 weeks later, than it was on the actual day? Do you know what I'm saying? Like, well, there's no, you know, what actually was achieved by that? And why would you use such a weapon? You know, there's a lot of weapons you could have used. Why is that the one?
What a name, too. Mother of all bombs. as you reported in the piece you wrote for the New York Times, this is a 21,600-pound bomb, and it bombed a tiny village. I mean, you can't even imagine. I mean, what did it look like in the aftermath when you visited?
we never got close enough to it to know.
So you couldn't see anything?
Mm-mm. No. I mean, we could see, like, the helicopters flying overhead. Oh. You know, they said the area had been evacuated, which because, like, the Daesh were fighting in that area as well. But the whole thing is just, like, there was no, there was no evidence, there was no, it was just numbers and names of countries and nothing else. Or, like, you don't even know if it had an impact on the environment and the health of that area, you know? Because, again, if it's, I mean, I don't know what that means, non-nuclear device. Like, right. What is the environmental impact of something like that?
Ellie, you wrote back then, I went to bed that night sad with the knowledge that my homeland was still simply a staging ground for foreign nations to project their power. I mean, that's a really powerful sentence when you think about this massive military might, the United States, yes. That has access to these massive bombs that the mind can't even comprehend and sets up these massive military bases with fast food from the United States. I mean, how are you, given that you do really amazing work on the ground with a number of, you write for U.S. media organizations, you work with Western outlets, how are you really kind of thinking about, you know, where your country is right now and what's next?
I don't know. I think you can only hope that, I mean, that's the other thing is like, I think the only thing we can do is hope that it somehow gets better, that something works out. But it's difficult because a lot of people around you are very scared, you know, and they keep saying, and I mean, obviously I'm comfortable in the fact that if I ever need to get out, you know, I can easily get out. But that's not an option you want to take. It's not something you actually actively want to do. But more than that, it's just this idea of you see all of these people around you who can't do that, who don't have that choice. And, you know, you want to, you want to try and comfort them, or you want to try and say, like, no, let's hope it gets better, you know? Let's hope that, like, something works out, that it doesn't get to that point. But you can't control that. You can't guarantee that by any means.
Today we're speaking with Ali Latifi, an independent journalist based in Kabul. He wrote a recent piece for Al Jazeera about Afghans who are taking up arms because of Taliban advances. He also produced a recent segment for the PBS NewsHour with correspondent Jane Ferguson. If you have any questions for Ali, we're gonna stay with him for about seven or so more minutes. The number is 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. What do you think of the media coverage? And this is your chance to talk to someone who has been reporting from Afghanistan for years and is living with the aftermath of the invasion of Afghanistan, the U.S. invasion. Ali, you mentioned the people who are going to leave, and I'm so glad you brought this up. Because one thing I've been hearing in the U.S. media, especially on public radio, is that you've got politicians in the U.S. who served in Afghanistan who are putting a campaign together to pressure the Biden administration to bring over Afghan translators and Afghans who served with military members. And it's spun as kind of a positive thing. And I thought to myself, this is so sad that people feel no choice but to leave their country. And I just wonder what your thoughts about that. What are your thoughts about that and how that's being covered in the U.S. press?
You know, I've met a few of them in recent months, and I think what's, you know, a lot of them have been really betrayed. You know, some of them just had the whole thing canceled outright at one point. A lot of them, you know, because of sort of bureaucratic things, like if you mistake, you know, you don't always remember what year you did what or what month you went where, you know. Or sometimes you may not know all of, you know, like certain names and things like that. But that gets held against you in this process. If you make a mistake like that, there are so many people that, because, you know, they don't have exact dates and exact places and you know, all, every detail down to the last point aren't, you know, are being delayed or aren't getting any answers. Or, for instance, you know, you have so when I lived in the U.S., there was this company that basically provided translators and linguists to Afghanistan, and it was constantly advertising on Afghan TV in the U.S., just constantly advertising on it as like, this is a way to make quick money, you know, for Afghan people in the U.S. to come to Afghanistan and do this. So I only ever saw it from that viewpoint. And I remember they must have been doing phenomenally well, because when I lived in D.C. for grad school, all of the bus ads on the D.C. metro system and all of the wraparound ads on the D.C. metro trains for I forget how long were their ads, which obviously they know their target audience, because those trains also go to Virginia and Maryland, where a lot of people from Afghanistan live. Hmm. And so to me, I saw it from that angle, and I saw the corruption from that side of it. And then seeing it from this side and seeing that, you know, people are literally being held back because of bureaucratic matters or because they can't get, what's it called? Like, they can't get documents and Word and verification from, you know, whoever they worked with 10 years ago, you know, because a lot of these people that come in and out, I think that's the saddest part, is that there are people waiting for essentially just bureaucratic matters.
Hmm. Ali, we have a question from a listener who says, are you worried that you and your family will be targeted by the Taliban because of your Western ties and your work as a journalist?
I don't know if I specifically would be targeted, but a lot of people are targeted, and it's a major issue. It's the major, and this is part of why people want out. These linguists, even like we met, like human rights workers, who say they want out because they're afraid that, you know, they will be known as people who work towards human rights and democracy and, you know, are espoused. The Taliban have said, they put out a statement like, oh, if you really sort of like repent for your quote unquote crime, we won't do anything to you. But the question is, how would you ever prove that to them? Like, what do they want you to do? And who decides whether or not your quote unquote repentance is enough, you know? Mm-hmm. Because like, what, is it just that random Talib who comes to your door? Or do you have to go to some kind of an elder figure amongst the Taliban, or some kind of an official? You know what I'm saying? Like that's just a statement that doesn't actually reassure anybody. So this is part of why people want out.
Ali, what about the Taliban? I mean, some of the things that are being reported now are very, very disturbing. Shahrazad Akbar, who is the chairperson
She's of amazing.
Afghanistan IHRC, she's been tweeting so much. She says, as an Afghan woman, I don't have that option to talk about happy things. I have to worry about a looming gender apartheid. And she pointed to an Observer piece about the Taliban ordering the flogging of a woman inside of her home. Uh-huh. Okay, first of all, how do you think the media should now cover the Taliban? Because like I said, it was the first two stories of the BBC. So how do the media ensure that what they are reporting is actually factual and includes some context?
The factual part is often difficult, because, you know, if you're reporting about something that happened, especially if it's like not firsthand in let's say in an area controlled by them, you know, that's always difficult. I do think the context is highly important. And I think that that's often what, you know, That's what's generally missing in a lot of news, right? It is the context behind certain things. I'm not saying that I don't mean that you know, the Taliban should be given a pass or anything like that. But I think it's important to, okay, if you're going to report it, you know, yes, the U.S. withdrawal is a part of it, but it's not the only part of it. And it shouldn't necessarily be the entire focus of what you're saying. The focus should be on what's happening, you know, on this case of this woman or of, you know, whatever district or area that is being written about. Because if you make it, you know, because at the end of the day, you know, Joe Biden will only be president for so much longer. But what matters is what will be left here. You know, what came from Bush and Obama and Trump and now him, and also what will be left here after his pullout. Not necessarily just, I think there's a lot of focus on the pullout, you know?
Right.
And the Taliban in relation to that pullout and everything else in relation to that pullout. But like, how long can you write about that? You know, because at a certain point that's going to get old. But what matters more is sort of the context around it, everything that preceded it, and possibly what's happening now.
Ali, before we let you go, I want to ask about young people. When we had you on with two young Afghan journalists, we got a lot of emails from listeners just saying thank you, because you don't hear from young Afghans very much. You know, we've done shows with young Iraqis, young Palestinians. And what we've heard from young people is they say, look, we have social media. We're so connected now, and we're tired of this. What are you hearing from young people right now, especially?
So I'll give you an example of a friend of mine. She's a famous female photographer, famous on Instagram. And we were talking about this the other day. And she was saying, I just care that my family is safe. I have to concentrate on making sure that my family is safe. I have to get them out. You know, she was saying that, like, I'm just one person. If something happens to me, it happens. But like, this is the place that I live. This is the place that I work. You know, this is the place where I know I can do something. So I'm willing to stay here, but I need to make sure that my family is okay. Hmm. And that's something obviously, you know, I hang out in very specific circles a lot of the time, who have a lot more access to things than the average young person, but that's just sort of the feeling, you know. Or even if I talk to, you know, older people in my own family, they keep saying, like, or my own relatives, you know, they keep saying that we have to make sure that our children are okay. So it's sort of this idea of responsibility on both ends.
Well, Ali, thank you so much for your reporting. It sounds kind of silly to say this, but I think it's so important to humanize people. I have not really heard from that many Afghans in most of the coverage in the last couple of weeks. So we will have you on again. We'll do an entire hour. Thank you so much for your reporting, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Ali Latifi is an independent journalist based in Kabul. He produced a recent segment for the PBS NewsHour with correspondent Jane Ferguson and wrote a piece for Al Jazeera about Afghans who were taking up arms because of Taliban advances. Coming up after a break, we will speak with Iraqi poet Sinan Antoun about the legacy of Donald Rumsfeld. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We'll be back after this.